Hello, listeners, and welcome to this special edition of Army Matters. Thank you for joining us. My name is Mark Holland, and I am the Director for Government Affairs here at the Association of the United States Army. Today, we are honored to be with Lieutenant General Ronald Place, who is the Director of the Defense Health Agency. Lieutenant General Place is a U.S. Army medical doctor and surgeon, and he leads the Defense Health Agency, which ensures the medical readiness of our armed forces, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force. DHA also provides quality healthcare services for our military families, retirees, and other beneficiaries. Sir, welcome.
Thanks for having me. In particular, my thanks to General Hamm, for you, Mark, Patty, for having me today, and really the ability to share what's going on within the military health system and specifically within the Defense Health Agency with all your listeners.
Yes, sir. And we're also joined today by my colleague and AUSA Director for Army Family Readiness, Mrs. Patty Barron.
Thank you, Mark.
General Place, sir, again, welcome and thank you for joining us today to discuss the military health system and the coming changes to healthcare in the military services. Sir, you became the Defense Department's most senior military medical leader this past year, but being part of the transition changes the military health system is going through is not new to you. Could you please tell us a little bit about your background and how your service as an Army medical doctor and surgeon, as well as your leadership assignments at senior Army and DoD levels, have helped to prepare you for this current assignment?
Thanks for the question. So that's actually the way that I think through decision making. Certainly as an executive, I consider what it means to be the director of the DHA, but really I think of myself as a soldier, as a physician, as a husband of an Army family member, as a father of what used to be former dependents, but now two of them are active soldiers themselves, and as the grandfather of grandchildren also receiving care as part of the military health system. I think about it that way. In terms of how I describe myself as a surgeon, that means all of my time meeting with individuals in our hospitals and medical centers across the Army medicine. But in addition to that, my combat deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq and Kosovo, and what it means to be in support of soldiers, and at least in my case, in support of Marines and airmen in combat as well. What do those injuries mean? And what does the preparation for that mean? What does modernization mean for us in the healthcare community? And what does modernization mean for the services so that they're better, they're stronger, they're safer, et cetera? And how do we balance all of those things? So I take that all into consideration and then into my job as the director of the DHA, knowing that the Defense Health Agency is a relatively new organization. It's only been around for a little more than 6 years. It was conceived of the idea that there are some things that the military departments, the services themselves need to continue doing, but there are some things that can be more effectively done if you just bring it all together. There's a list of them, facility management being one of them, or how do we handle the TRICARE health benefit program, the TRICARE health program as another of them. How can we bring that all together in a single agency? And the way that then the Defense Health Agency takes that information, it then leads into the four main priorities that within the Defense Health Agency we're trying to lead through. And the first of those is great outcomes. And when you think of great outcomes, most of you are probably thinking about, okay, that means you get out of the hospital okay. But that's not really what it means. What it means is, how can we prevent injury from happening, in particular our soldiers, but then learn about that. So how can we prevent injury or illness from happening to our family members, to our retirees and retiree family members? And if they are diagnosed with a particular illness or injury or cancer or whatever it is, then how can we take the best of what we have to assure that the uniformed members, active and reserve components, how can we quickly get them back to optimal health and get back to duty? And by the same token, learn from that to do the same things for our families. How can we get them back to work? Or how can we get back to being a more functional stay-at-home parent or whatever it is that they do? And similarly, how do we take those same sorts of lessons to our retirees and retiree family members? And then along the way, how can we take into account the patient-reported outcomes, like quality of life things? So it matters if I'm cured from my disease process, whatever it is, but also matters how I feel at the end of all that. Not just that I'm cured from it, whatever it may be, but what's my quality of life look like? And what did the process feel like? What was the level of empathy and compassion? How was I treated? How respectful was it? How responsive to my needs, whether it was to be seen as a patient in a clinic somewhere, or my needs addressed through virtual health or over the telephone, all of those sorts of things. And then last, how is it that the entire system feels. How does it feel for the patient? How does it feel for the staff? And how collaborative do we all feel together? Those are the major priorities that we try to work through. So whether that's today or any of the functions that we're trying to lead through, can we use those priorities to help us in our decision making?
I'm just really encouraged to hear that because I think it's so incredibly important to look at it from the lens of the recipient, the patient, but also that holistic approach. It's not just the patient. It's everyone that comes in touch with that patient. And it's not just the process of making sure that you don't get ill, which is, I think, the best method that we have towards supporting our families. But really, once they are ill, injured, or wounded, you know, what happens to them through the process and then what happens afterwards?
And I was just going to say, with Patty and I, we both experienced rich Army lives. And so we are particularly glad that you, as a soldier yourself, are leading this important transformation for the Department of Defense. Sir, now, regarding changes occurring in the military's health system, would you please highlight the background and explain to our listeners how the Defense Department and military services have come to where we are today? Or in other words, what are the main reasons for the changes to the military health system, please?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That's really a great question. And that's because the military health system is undergoing its largest, most comprehensive change in probably the last 30 years, and maybe even longer. Almost every element of the functions of the military health system have at least been evaluated, and many of them are undergoing some changes. Now, as I mentioned, the Defense Health Agency has only been around for 6 or 7 years or so. The Defense Health Agency has a responsibility for managing the TRICARE health plan. Now, the good news is, for all of this, almost nothing is changing in the TRICARE health plan. Now, iteratively, as new methodologies or new treatments or new medications are discovered, we'll add them to that. But I think it's important for your listeners to understand that first, that TRICARE health program isn't changing.
Right.
What's mostly changing is what's happening inside of our own internal facilities, our Department of Defense hospitals and clinics and those sorts of things. And I'd like to describe what I think is four major lines of effort that are transforming within our internal systems. And the first of those is, just by virtue of me being here, the fact that we're transitioning from Army medical treatment facilities and Navy medical treatment facilities and Air Force medical treatment facilities to Defense Health Agency medical treatment facilities, which means that rather than three separate organizations giving guidance about what happens in these facilities and policy development associated with them, it's being standardized into one. The good part of that there is, as we move across the nation from place to place, and even if it's no longer an Army place, that soldiers perhaps will get healthcare in an Air Force location, or sailors would get healthcare in an Army location, the standardization of that process, in particular patient-facing processes, like how do you make an appointment, or how does the pharmacy work, or how does the laboratory work, they'll all be standardized such that the ability of individual patients, and in particular, those family members who tend to be the leaders for their families for the entirety of the family's healthcare, will understand how to do it because it'll be standardized everywhere. The second major change has to do with a reduction of military uniform medical manpower. So across the services, in support of the Secretary of Defense, in evaluation of what was the requirement for uniformed medical practitioners against the mission sets that exist across the entire Department of Defense, and then balance the requirements of the numbers of healthcare practitioners against the requirements for some of the other things that the services have to do. So for example, if we have to have more fighters in the Air Force, where do those people come from? If we need more people on ships in the Air Force, where do those people come from? If we have new SFABs, for example, where do those soldiers come from? Well, the department and the services within the greater Department of Defense are balancing the requirements. The feeling is that with low risk, there can be less uniformed members providing healthcare. And then that transitions back to my organization's responsibility. Then, well, where do you find those people? Is it more civilians or contractors working inside of our facilities? Is it leveraging the contract relationships we have with our managed care support contractors, the TRICARE health plan, to have them downtown? And what's the right relationship at every single location to be able to do that? The third line of effort is similar to that, and that is from a facilities perspective. What facilities do you need and what capabilities need to happen inside those facilities? You may be aware, and your listeners may be aware, that the department sent a report over to the Congress within the last couple of weeks, that showed some changes perhaps in what might be happening in some of those facilities over the next 2 to 5 years or so, with the idea that many of those uniformed medical practitioners aren't getting the full spectrum of disease processes or volume of people with particular disease processes to maintain their currency and competency to be able to do what we want them to do in an operational environment. And so because of that, take some of those staff out of those outpatient clinics and put them in hospitals and medical centers so that they can have that readiness capability. Well, if that's the case, then my responsibility as the director of the DHA is to find the primary care staff and to find the specialty care staff at those few locations to be able to assure a warm handoff of care such that our beneficiaries get great care, and yet we're still maintaining the readiness that are associated with each of those uniform practitioners. And then finally, a huge line of effort for us, probably invisible to our listeners, is a complete overhaul of our electronic health record system, a brand new commercial off-the-shelf electronic health record, the same things that are going into the best hospitals and clinics across America, leveraging that capability and still having within our systems. So a tool, electronic health record, in support of all that other transformational work that's happening right now.
Thank you very much, sir. And I've had the opportunity to actually review the congressional report, and what strikes me is the plan is very methodical, and every medical center will be looked at individually.
Sir, I heard so many different things when you just explained the transformation, and a couple of things I want to just pull out because I think it's really important that our listeners hear it again. What I thought you said was that, yes, you got a mandate to reduce military staff by 18,000, I believe, uniform members. But you did say that doesn't mean that those 18,000 spots will be gone. You might replace them with contractors or civilians. And if you can't do it in the MTF, then you're going to ensure that those types of services are available outside the gate. Is that
right? Yeah, Patty, that's exactly right. But for most of the hospitals and clinics, because they're sustainment platforms for the readiness of our medical forces. In other words, for me as a surgeon, I have to have an operating room. But in addition to an operating room, I need an outpatient clinic. And in addition to that, I need a volume of the right kinds of people with the right kinds of disease processes that allow me to practice my skill. And some of that's in the operating room. Some of that's in the intensive care unit. Some of that's on a medical surgical ward. And oh, by the way, those same sort of folks who are going to be helping me here in our fixed facilities in America, they're also going to deploy with me those same OR nurses, those same OR technicians, those same ICU nurses, the same pharmacy staff, the same rehabilitation staff, respiratory therapists to help me manage the ventilator, for example, in the ICU. All that needs to be exercised. And so even with the reductions of military manpower, we still need the full staff to be able to manage those sustainment platforms. So many of them will, in fact, be replaced with civilian staff. Now, whether they're civilian governmental employees or individual contracted employees, there's some pluses and minuses for both of those systems, but there will be an increase of civilian employees in some of our locations to make sure that we're fully fleshed out with our capabilities to maintain them as sustainment platforms.
Absolutely. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that it's a great opportunity for military spouses in the health fields to possibly find employment.
Oh, yes, ma'am. And in addition, if we are better able to standardize some of this, then to have our military spouses PCS with their sponsor, then it becomes easier and easier to do it because the system is the same everywhere.
That's really encouraging. And sir, as you know, you've explained that there have been some changes at the report that was sent to Congress. And because of that report, there have been many articles that have come out in Military Times or other places about the military facility closures and the transferring of family members and retirees into the civilian healthcare system. This is a perfect opportunity to hear it from the folks that are doing it and not rely on rumors, because I think rumors just make it so much worse than anything else. If you can shed a little light on what is actually going on, what families can expect, and who might be affected. For example, taking family members and retirees out of the MTFs and into the TRICARE network will result in more money out of pocket. Can you address some of these issues?
Yeah, Patty, thanks for asking that question. In fact, I think it's the most common question that we're receiving both from our patients inside the MTFs as well as to some of our social media sites where people are asking, it's just, what's going on? Can you explain it to us? The first thing I'd like to be able to talk through is of the 450 military medical treatment facilities around the world, only those in the United States and the United States territories were evaluated by this particular proposal. And of those, almost 400, well, I should say closer to 350, almost 350 facilities, about a fourth of them were looked at with real rigor. With the remainder, there's too much readiness that's happening there. There's not nearly enough on the TRICARE network, et cetera. So for three-fourths of them, it just didn't look like there was any even anything we could look at. And of those one-fourth that were the remainder, the real idea was how much readiness is being generated there, and if not much, what exists in the TRICARE network and how can we partner? And then that's where the deep dive of information really happened. And it was months and months and months of effort between the TRICARE health plan, the locations, the senior leaders, et cetera, so we could get as much information, rich, detailed information about what's happening there. And these were the few facilities that we truly believed weren't generating readiness for the medical staff. In fact, we call it burning readiness, that we were less ready by working there than we were before. And so then the requirement becomes for the Defense Health Agency, how do you partner with the local communities to assure a warm handoff? And so then we look back to what have the military services in particular, how have they done this before? So for your Army listeners, you only have to think back 3 or 4 years ago when the Army took the hospitals at Fort Jackson or Fort Sill or Fort Knox and descoped them to make them into outpatient clinics. And so we in the DHA, we've gotten all the after action reports from those locations, what worked well, what didn't work well. And here's some of the big picture items that we've learned. The first of which is when it comes to the transition, you have to over communicate. And so what's happening at your location and why? Second, this isn't a fast thing. For this to be effective for our beneficiaries, for our family members, and for our retiree family members, this has to take time. And we have to find people in the community who are willing to take on our beneficiaries as part of their primary care panels. And in many cases, that means a warm handoff. In other words, we help make the introduction. This is who you have now in the military health system. This is who we recommend for you. We like to set up your first appointment for you. In many cases, our beneficiaries love that. In some cases, they came back to us and said, yeah, but what if I don't like that primary care provider? Well, then let us help you find another one. And I'll give you an example. In Fort Knox, over 7,000 retirees and retiree family members, through the assistance of the managed care support contractor, were able to make a warm handoff of them to other primary care staff members in the Fort Knox area. So those lessons we're going to use. Further, we'll talk about what are the benefits of TRICARE Prime versus TRICARE Select for active duty family members. For active duty family members who are Prime, of course, there's no cost at all, with the possible exception of copays if they choose to get their pharmaceuticals off the installation. They're still welcome to get their pharmaceuticals on the installation, in which case there'd be no cost, as opposed to TRICARE Select, which has some copays associated with it. And so learning a little bit about the two major plans, whether it's TRICARE Prime or TRICARE Select, and for your family, what will make the most difference. And then finally, for our retirees, clearly that will mean for those who are Prime, there's still copays for them, whether it's Prime or Select. So help them understand this is the rich benefit that you have. These would be the costs associated with being TRICARE Prime. These are the costs associated with being TRICARE Select. And then for all those, whether it's TRICARE or active duty family members who choose Select, or every portfolio chosen by TRICARE Prime or TRICARE Select, what are your catastrophic caps? And how do we help you understand what those catastrophic caps are and help you choose the right plan that's there for you? We intend to do all of that in every location of those few dozen MTFs that we're talking about that may be transitioning over the next 2, 3, 4, even 5 years.
And just a quick question about that. When you say warm handoff, and you know, which I think is an excellent opportunity to really support that transition, are you saying that the TRICARE provider does the warm handoff? Does DHA have someone within that MTF that's going to support that warm handoff? How does that work?
So it'd be something that we would handle internally. And before any handoffs would happen, there would be town halls to explain how the handoff would happen. And further, as we go through this process, nothing in life is static, of course. If the area around a particular clinic has changed significantly, such that in the past we thought, well, this can happen, and then new factors happen. For example, a hospital closes, or a major supplier of outpatient primary care closes and goes away or loses a whole bunch of their staff, then we would reassess, is it something that we can even do? Mm-hmm. And if the answer seems to be no, then go back to the department to say, this was the plan, here's why it was the plan, these are the factors that have changed, these are all the things that we've done to try to make it effective in this particular area, but we still can't get there from here. This is the modified plan. It may be, well, it's not 5 years, maybe it's 7 years. Or it may be, that's a bridge too far, we just can't get there in this location. Our recommendation is to turn off the transition and go back to having being an outpatient clinic for everyone. But this isn't a way to get out of doing it. the department fully believes that the Defense Health Agency will be successful in it, but expects me to come back to them if some factors change such that we just don't believe it's doable.
Well, I can certainly hear the passion in your voice. And so I know that you have put an awful lot of effort and thought into how this is going to happen. And the fact that it's very fluid, you know, it's really dependent on the items that you mentioned. So that's really reassuring. So let me ask you about Genesis, which is the medical record program that you mentioned earlier. So the new electronic health record program, it's currently being tested in certain locations, if I'm not mistaken. What can military healthcare recipients expect? And if we are transferring families into the civilian sector, will this system be helpful in the medical record transfer process?
Yeah, Patty, that's a great point. Thanks for bringing it up. So it's based off a commercial off-the-shelf program, and we believe that its functionality, the things that it does for us, is markedly better than our current electronic health record, the one that we developed inside the Department of Defense. And so the first advantage of it is much more functional than what we currently have. The second is we have an agreement with the Veterans Health Administration to have the same program. So in terms of our service members, for our soldiers as they retire and become veterans, it's seamless in that the system is the same. Next, the fact that because it's a commercial off-the-shelf program, our ability to use health information exchanges, so even with our civilian partners, because it's a program that they recognize, it markedly improves our ability to cross-match information with those who go out using the TRICARE health plan, whether it's in a hospital or a clinic or whatever, because it's that sort of program. So for lots of different ways, it makes good sense. But even more than that, from a safety perspective, what we're finding out is we're finding more information within our system. We're making unnecessary duplication of radiographic imaging less because we're finding that, oh, we already have that x-ray. We already have that CAT scan. We don't need to repeat it. Or sometimes when we go downtown and you get some lab test done or even imaging done, you come back to our system. You can't view it on our system, so we have to repeat it. Those elements are markedly decreasing. When it comes to the speed with which we're able to provide care, whether it's primary care or specialty care, in many cases, we're finding that while in the short term, it makes us slower, in the long term, it makes us faster. And anything that can enhance the amount of time that we can spend with our patients instead of with the electronic health record is a good thing. Now, we're not anywhere near a complete rollout. That'll take us another probably in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 years. But from the first pilot site, the initial operating capability site up in the Pacific Northwest, pretty significant challenges. And I think most of us know about that. The next wave in Northern California went much better. Not perfect. I don't mean to make everyone seem as all sunshine and butterflies, but it went much better. And yet we're learning from that again. The next wave, we call it the wave Nellis. So Nellis Air Force Base, Fallon Naval Air Station, 29 Palms, Fort Irwin, Beale Air Force Base, Vandenberg Air Force Base are just among the next that are in that system. Our goal is to take the lessons now learned from the first two sites at that particular site, and then as we roll that out, learn from that one, and so on, and so on, and so on. So we see huge advantages. We're not yet in the great advantages. We're in the good advantages timeframe right now, but we see great advantages as we continue to roll out this electronic health record.
Fantastic.
Thank you, sir. And this leads us to exceptional family members. And as the Defense Department transitions the military health system, we understand that families experience some consistency challenges with their exceptional family members. Could you share with us how exceptional family members will be a priority for the Defense Health Agency as you lead us through this major transformation?
Sure, Mark. Thank you for that. Family readiness is military readiness. I mean, all of us who have families know that. That if there are challenges associated with their families, whether it's in the forefront of our consciousness or in our subconscious, it affects the way that we handle our missions. And so we fundamentally believe that in the Defense Health Agency. And further, the challenges that are associated with those family members who are in the Exceptional Family Member Program are even more to the forefront for those of us who have them in our thinking. The military health system writ large, and for me, the Defense Health Agency, we're committed that we do it right for everyone, whether it's inside of our facilities or using the TRICARE health plan. Now, as I think all of you know, the most important time frame comes in one of the more stressful time frames, and that's a PCS move. And so we see ourselves in support of that. So first, how can we more effectively show what's available at every single location so that on this personnel move, right? The orders come from the personnel parts of the organization with the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine, the Coast Guard. How do you know what's really there? How do you really know within that specialty, what's the access to that care? And what are some of the specifics associated with it? How can we standardize a portfolio so that folks know what's actually there? Second, how can we build a system such that a referral that happens in my losing duty station can actually make it to my gaining duty station so that I'm not lost in transition? Now, how to do that may take some resources. And as we have already discussed, resourcing is sort of a challenge right now. But how can we work within our existing programs to at least facilitate that using the human connection? And then finally, how can we set up a communication system such that when there are challenges, not just from the orders part or the personnel part, but from the healthcare delivery part, how can we assure the families that they have some sort of repository to tell us the information so we have a better idea what problem it is that we're trying to fix, mm-hmm. as opposed to, well, these are the anecdotes that we're hearing, so we're going to fix anecdotes. Well, how can we get real data that shows what are the no kidding challenges, not anecdotes, and then put the most resources against those particular problems? We're not doing this alone. This is with the service medical departments. It's with the service personnel departments. We all have to be in this together, but we are fundamentally in agreement that we need to be part of it, and we are absolutely in support of the services as they're making their changes to the PCS systems.
Thank you, sir, for explaining. And we know the exceptional family members are highlighted in the recent report to Congress, so it's reassuring for us to see the importance and the priority that you and your leadership team are placing on exceptional family members. Sir, now shifting to a current medical headline that's not related to DOD's healthcare reform, but is indeed a major concern worldwide now, the coronavirus. Sir, would you please share with us what the Department of Defense is doing to address the risk the coronavirus presents to our armed forces, to include our military families, civilians, and retirees?
So the challenge with podcast is there's a date timestamp to everything associated with coronavirus right now, right? It's an explosion of information. So I want to be very careful about, this is midday on March 2nd that we're having this conversation. It likely is going to change even later today, let alone tomorrow or next week. So this is a whole of government approach. And in the United States, at least, the Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are the lead federal elements. The Department of Defense is in support of it. That includes, for example, some locations where housing has been provided. All that's being provided, HHS and the CDC are taking care of all of the other things. And it's our responsibility as DOD leaders to make sure that there's minimal to no interaction between any who are suspected or may have an infection from this novel coronavirus compared to the rest of the staff at those particular locations that we want to keep safe. So that's the first part of it. The second is our support of healthcare screening at particular airports. What information can we give? That sort of thing. And we are largely in support of, but still HHS and the CDC are the prime elements. When it comes to critical operations, each of the installation commanders have been given very broad authorities about protecting the health of their particular installation. And that guidance is coming out of the DOD. It's Force Health Protection. And so particular updates, as we know more, this is for a senior commander at a particular installation. Here's things that they can do to maintain the health of their force. And as that changes, the new force health protection guidance will be coming out. And then fourth, I'll just remind everyone what we can all do ourselves. And that's be aware, right? Whether it's the influenza or this particular virus or anything else, be aware of things that we can do to keep ourselves healthier. Routine immunizations. Immunizations have been proven to decrease the risk of infection, in particular of communicable diseases. Simple things like covering your mouth when you cough, but not with your hand that you're going to shake with somebody else, but into your shoulder, into your sleeve, or if you have a cough or sneezing, that's the one instance perhaps that wearing a mask would be effective. But a mask isn't going to be effective to keep others from infecting you. Viruses have no problem sneaking through the little holes in those masks, but they're good to catch the droplets that come out of our mouths as we sneeze. That's the utilization of a mask, for example. And then washing our hands relatively frequently, keeping our hands away from our mouth, our eyes, our noses, those sorts of things. So as we touch things that may have viruses on them, then we don't get them into our own systems. And we wash with soap and water for 20 to 30 seconds, or we use hand sanitizer that has the right amount of alcohol in it that's actually useful for it. Just common sense methodologies. And I would just say this, that we shouldn't be fearful of the coronavirus. We should be smart about the coronavirus. And how can we help our brothers and sisters in arms? How can we help family members who are perhaps more at risk, those who are aged, those who have other health problems associated with them? And how can we keep them out of areas that there may be risk to them? And how can we be the go-between, whether it means shopping for someone who needs help or doing some sort of chores, as I was taught as a child, chores around the house for people who perhaps can't get out? How can we help each other out as Americans? That'd be my best advice, at least as of today.
Thank you, sir. Being smart, not fearful, that's good advice for all of us. In fact, this morning at our AUSA staff meeting, we even discussed preventive measures that we should all be taking, sort of like a review for ourselves, the things we can do and will be doing just to try to remain healthy and hopefully avoid the coronavirus.
Yeah, and let me add on to that one more thing. One of the benefits that we have in the military health system that many don't is the nurse advice line. For many of us growing up, the nurse was mom, and some of our moms or even dads were more well-trained and actually were registered nurses or licensed practical nurses. But we all wish we had that mom that we could call. And in the military health system, we do. It's called the nurse advice line. Mm-hmm. And if there's a question about how you're feeling, should you seek care, should you stay at home, that sort of thing, that's a perfect question to send into our nurse advice line. And I'd be happy to give your listeners the website if you're interested in it.
Absolutely.
Yes, please.
All right. So just to say it out loud, www.mhsnurseadviceline. So NURSEADVICELINE.com.
The Nurse Advice Line. Thank you, sir. Now, as we conclude our podcast today, any final remarks for our listeners?
Well, there's lots of changes underway, and I understand how confusing that can be for some. Our responsibility within the military health system is try to get order out of this confusion, how to put knowledge against this complexity such that rather than it being a challenge for those that we're privileged to care for in the military health system, instead it actually leads to a greater understanding of it and greater health that ultimately comes out of our system. That's the first thing. Second, I fundamentally understand how important this is. And I also understand why it can be an emotional issue. After all, healthcare is a deeply emotional thing. And so while I'd hope that all of our interactions can be professional and understanding, I also get how it can be frustrating and in some cases lead to anger among some. That doesn't make it okay, but I do understand how we get there. My hope, though, is through information, we can lessen the amount of confusion, we can lessen the amount of anger, and instead collectively work toward solutions for those who are going through challenging times in their lives, in particular for really difficult medical decision-making. But the fact of the matter is there's 9.5 million beneficiaries in the military health system, and there are dozens of appointments per beneficiary per year. And of those individual appointments, there are dozens to even hundreds of touch points for every single one of them, which means that there are hundreds of millions, no, rather billions of opportunities for mistakes to be made. So I know they're going to happen. But how we recover from those mistakes is what matters equally to me. How can we collectively solve those challenges together? How can we show empathy to both the beneficiaries who are going through a challenging problem as well as to the staff who day after day after day are putting their heart and soul into caring for America's sons and daughters? And collectively, I'm confident that we can work together to make this a better system. But it's going to be better. It'll take patience. It'll take hard work. It'll take togetherness to get there. So thanks again for allowing me to share this time with you to be able to put out just a little bit of information and to know that we care very deeply about what it means to be taken care of the pride and joy of America.
Sir, that definitely came through loud and clear. We really do appreciate you coming here and giving us all this information. And you're absolutely right. Information is key. The more that we can communicate with each other, the better we'll make the system. And you certainly are very open to making sure that that happens. And I just want you to know from Mark and I's perspective in our different capacities, but also from all of AUSA, that we're really here to support you. Because if you win, we win. And we want all of us to win. And we want to be able to help our soldiers and their families, retirees, and other beneficiaries to understand, to prepare for, and to successfully transition to the changes that you've discussed with us today. And we really do thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Join us next Monday with a brand new episode of Army Matters with Army Real Talk. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's Professional Association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Pua.